We are talking today, June 28, 1972, with Mrs. Elizabeth Terwilliger, Bay Area environmentalist whose interests encompass hiking, biking, canoeing, teaching, and outdoor education. We are in her home at 308 Oakdale, Mill Valley. The interviewer is Dorothy Slate.
Oh my, lovely view.
It's right here. It's quiet.
Yeah.
You just look right out into the woods. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
The hills, the trees. You don't see the hills, but and you can't see. As a matter of fact, one of my neighbors said, "Well, but don't be disappointed. I live up in the hill over here, and I can't see much."
Oh. You have a palm tree. That's unusual.
There are two date palms. And this was the front door. You didn't come in this way. You came in the little stream this way, and this road. It was a road, and it covered the stream right there, and it went up to the house next door and to this house. So this house is one of the oldest ones in Mill Valley, and it's been remodeled by the different people who lived here, because you came in the front door and you went into the kitchen that way, and this was the living room, and that apparently was the dining room, and that was the big back porch.
Oh.
And then whoever lived here decided this was California, they were going to plant everything they ever heard of that grew in California. Those orange trees, lemon trees, fig trees, pear trees, apple trees, walnut trees, many varieties of plum. And it's just exciting to go out into New York.
Do these all bear?
Yes, they all bear. There is a pear tree. I remember at one time we were in Herman Hines' class a long time ago, and he told about there's a yard in Mill Valley that has a huge winter pear. And we moved here, sure enough. The pear is tremendous. It's just like this. I've never seen one like it.
Gosh.
And then there's grapevines and young berry vines, and there was an apricot tree. But not only that, but there are non-natives, such as fan palms and bamboo and magnolia, and there's holly, which doesn't belong in a shady area, plus all the natives. There's redwood, there's buckeye, there are alders, and bays, and so it's just exciting. I usually have the scouts come here, or the campfire, or whatever. We meet here first, we talk about what's native, and what are the other things, what's poisonous, what's not poisonous. It's just fun.
Oh, lovely. Now, let's see. The first question I was supposed to ask is, when did you move to Mill Valley? When you first came here with...
I never can remember the time.
Yeah.
We came here when my daughter was in the fourth grade. She is now in her third year teaching first grade. She has moved to Colorado because she decided California was too crowded and too much smog, so she went to Colorado.
Yeah, well, she finds
it. Then she went through the high school here and went to Mills College.
Mm-hmm.
And so Johnny then, of course, was in the second grade. Mm-hmm. And so we've been there ever since he just graduated from college. And Mill Valley is nice because you're out, depending on where you live again, of course, you're out of the wind. Again, in this class at Herman Hein, who used to live in Mill Valley and was an outstanding architect, we would go to his classes. And he says, now when you move to Marin County, you look around. Where you see grass, there is wind.
Oh.
And the wind comes directly through the valleys and over the hills like this. So if you want to be where you see trees, it's out of the wind.
Uh-huh.
And so this is one of the exciting things about Marin County. And then when we moved here, we have this little tiny stream here, and here are the redwoods. But then you realize now these are second growth redwoods. That years ago they came in and cut down the first growth. This is a second growth coming up, which makes it kind of exciting. And then the other day I was out there, and usually if you could look at the base of a redwood tree, if it looks kind of peeled off, this is where a deer has come, and the velvet on the antlers get very itchy, and they rub on the bark with their antlers to get the velvet off. And suddenly I looked up, but way up high, the bark was also off. I thought, well, no deer could reach that high. So then I watched, and a little California gray squirrel came down, and with his forepaws scraped off some of the bark, put it in his mouth, climbed back up the tree and took it to his nest, came back and scratched some more bark off, put it in his mouth, and took it back up to the nest.
Do they eat that, or do they
No, this is to build their nest with it.
Oh.
And I thought this was kind of interesting. I had never noticed this before.
Oh.
And then when you go into the woods, then you get to... You can hear all the sounds, and you can hear the gray squirrel scolding. And then you watch, and you can see him leaping from tree to tree. And then as you stand in the woods, you hear, and when we first moved here, my son thought it was an owl. I said, wait a minute, let's look. Well, many band-tailed pigeons sleep in this area, and they fly out in a huge flock each morning to go to the rest of the county to feed on the madrone berries, And then as you stand there, you listen and you watch, and sure enough, here they come back at night to go in the trees. As a matter of fact, I had taken a class in, not ornithology, but in the study of birds one time, and the man, professor from the East Bay, we would meet each Saturday in a different place. We were standing at the College of Marin, and he said, this was at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he said, the band-tailed pigeons and the robins sleep in Mill Valley, but they come out to the rest of the county to feed. I thought, I live in Mill Valley. Here is this man from across the bay telling me that the band-tailed pigeons and the robins sleep in Mill Valley. I said, what does he know that I don't know that he can see, that I haven't seen? I said, well, I better go home and open my eyes. So the following afternoon, I had some Girl Scouts coming to my house. I said, you know what? I just met a man from East Bay, and he said, the robins sleep in Mill Valley. Now, let's watch. And sure enough, the girls are here from about 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock. And as we stood there, here came the robins right over our heads into the trees and back. And then another thing down here on Walnut and in several places in Mill Valley, there are black-crowned night herons. Now, black-crowned night herons sleep all day. Then the minute the sun goes down, they say, whoop! And out they come to feed all along the shore. Now, a lot of people don't know this. As a matter of fact, one day, one of the students that had been with me on some field trips said, Miss Troder, I'm down here by Eggers, and I'm looking at a bird in a tree that looks like a kiwi bird, but I know we don't have kiwi birds here in Australia. What can it be? And I said, I'll be down in a minute. It's probably going to be an immature black-crowned night heron. And the young black-crowned night herons are just brown speckles, whereas the adult has a white body and a gray coat and a black cap and sort of a greenish bill and greenish legs. And so he's called a black-crowned night heron. And just not long ago, we were canoeing back from Richardson Bay Bridge back into the Mill Valley Harbor, and here they came. The sun had gone down, the moon was beginning to come up, the beautiful glow of the sunset was all around, and in groups of threes and fours came the black-crowned night herons out to feed all night along the shore with their quap, quap, quap. A lot of people don't even know they're here in the town. I mean, right here in Mill Valley, they're in South Lake.
I've heard that sound like an owl near our house.
Then the other day, I was going on a hike, and usually we talk about the great horned owl, and he says five notes. Well, I saw two of these sitting on a wire. And one was saying, and the other one was saying,
yeah.
That's not silly. I watched again, and sure enough, one of them said, and the other one said,
yeah.
I don't know whether this was Mother objecting to go where Daddy wanted, or whether it was Junior and his voice was just changing. And then I heard, and this is the barn owl. And then at night, if you're standing down at the City Hall, and in the tower right above the City Hall, there is a little screech owl. And every night, he's screeching. And of course, he's hard to see because screech owls are very tiny. I have one in my deep freeze. And they're very soft. And this is why they're called a screech owl. And you hear this racket coming out from this sort of a bell tower thing above where the fire department is down there. It's just a screech. And then all around in Mill Valley, we have the both jays. Now, a lot of people say, well, I saw that jay, but wait a minute, we have two jays. I have the children paint their whole heads black. And then put your hand on top of your head and open your fingers, and this makes a crest. Paint that black, too. And then paint two blue lines straight above your eyebrow like this, and then paint the rest of you all blue. Then you're the Steller's jay. Now, Mr. Steller was a German biologist who went with Bering to discover America on this side. And so, being the first one to see this bird, it was named after them, after him, rather. So I tell the children, now, someday you'll find a bird that, or something that nobody else has ever found, and it'll be one. And then we put our little blue hats on, and our white shirts, and our blue coats, and our blue jeans, and we put a gray backpack on their back, and then we're the California scrub jay. And then the scrub jays are the guardian of the woods, and the minute you come in, they tell everybody that you're there, jay, 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 because you just can't tell what people are going to do, and so they just warn everybody. And just like when you go down on the along Mill Valley Harbor, the killdeer is down, and the killdeer is the guardian of the seashore. And when he sees you coming, he calls up, "Killer, killer, killer!" But not only is he doing that, the killdeer has only three toes, so he cannot build his nest in a tree. So he lays his eggs right there on the ground. Well, you don't know it because they match so perfectly. But, and then he sees you coming, and he said, "Oh dear. Here come all those people. They're going to step on my head. I've got to do something." So I have the children hold their arms out in a bent position like this, and then sort of let one limp. so that as you go for a walk, you doubt the beach, you say, look at that poor bird. It looks like he's got a broken wing. Maybe I can help him. But can you help him? No. What's he doing? He's leading you away from his home. But the other day we were down there in the first grade class down there, and there were two crows, and we heard the killdeer crying and crying and crying, so that we knew that the crows were eating the eggs for lunch. So I told the children about that day, the crows just said we had to have some scrambled eggs for lunch. The killdeer just have to go lay some more eggs.
Oh, and they can do it, too.
Yeah,
huh?
They can do it. Yeah, they're just all down
there. Oh, God. What is your favorite age group to take on walks?
Preschoolers up first, second, and third grade, even the fourth and fifth grade. Above that, they get a little blasé. But below that, although the older people, there are a lot of retired people now who for the first time are having time to look and listen. And this is what's fun, because suddenly they will see things that have been there all their lives, mm-hmm. but just are suddenly aware of them. Because I used to go on a field trip with a lady, and I'd have the field glasses in one hand and the bird book in the other, and I'd name a bird, and she'd say, how do you know? Did you have it in your hand? And I thought, have it in your hand? How do you have a bird in your hand? A bird in hand's worth two and a bush, but that doesn't mean it's in your hand. So many people have big windows that the birds break their necks on. And they bring them to me. And then you get to hold the bird in your hand. And by holding him in your hand, you get to see things you would never see otherwise. And the cedar waxwings, which are in Mill Valley in huge flocks, in December, January, and February, because they're here in the winter eating all the pyracanthus berries that are around. When you hold one of those in your hand, they are just gorgeous. They have this beautiful black band across their eyes, and they have this delicate, soft yellow belly, and then a brilliant yellow band along the base of the tail, and then on the male, at the tips of the wings, a bright little red quill. They're just gorgeous. And when you go for a walk, you hear a squeak, and you look around, and then you look up, and there sitting on the wire will be a whole flock of cedar waxwings, and they'll dive down to a pyracanthus bush or a cotoneaster and just have berries for lunch.
Sounds delicious.
And then when you go for a walk in the woods, you hear whispering, pss, 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 pss. This is the little bush tail, about the size of your little finger, and all gray, and they fly in flocks. And it's not people whispering, it's just the little bush tail.
I've never seen any of that small.
Well, they're tiny, they fly in flocks, just no bigger than your little finger. And then when you go for a walk in the woods, you hear a squeak that's like a mouse, but it's up high, so you know it wouldn't be a mouse. A little bird about the size of a little finger, paint your little finger all brown and give it a curved bill like this, and then creep up the tree and stop, and creep up the tree and stop, and creep around the tree and stop. And you know when a branch breaks off of the tree and leaves sort of a knot? Well, the minute that little brown creeper stops, you can't tell him from a knot. And he just squeaks like a mouse. And then when you go for a walk in the woods and you hear something saying, yank, 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 then you look up in the tree and you paint the back of the little bird gray and the front of it white, and you give it a bill like your two fingers together like this, and this is a nuthatch. And he says, yank, 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 yank. So as your ears become aware, and then your eyes become aware, then suddenly you look up, and then with the children, we pretend we have a hummingbird in our hand, and we pretend it's Mother Hummingbird, and she gets very tired sitting on the nest. So the daddy says, I'll do a song and dance for you. And so we put the daddy out here, and you go, zing, 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 zing. And then without a sound, the daddy goes, way up in the air. And he turns around and he comes down, zing, like this. I have the children do this. And then the next time I see them, they'll say, I heard him say, do just what you said.
Oh, that's satisfying, isn't it? How many would you say are ideal to take on these walks with the
a classroom at a time?
A whole classroom.
He's in the front. The whole classroom is all right. Mm-hmm. With the teacher, and I usually like some mothers along too, because what's interesting by having the mothers along, a lot of the people are from other parts of the United States, and to them California is new and they don't know about the out-of-doors, and so I like them to learn also about the out-of-doors. Because one of the little things that I use in teaching children about snakes, I come from Honolulu, we have no snakes. I had never seen a snake until I came here. Mm-hmm. And then I have the children hold up their first finger like this, and then I have them feel their first finger that it goes in a little bit at the first knuckle. Then I have them hold their little finger up like this and pretend it's a pencil point. Now, in California, where we live, if you go for a walk and you find a snake whose head is like your finger and whose tail is like a pencil point, you can pick it up. But wait a minute, everybody make a fist like this and hold your finger like this and pretend it's a mouse. Put the mouse in, he can get up, can't he? Does a snake have hands to eat with? No. So then Mother Nature says, I'm going to help you. So we change the shape of our hand so that it looks like a claw, and we'll pretend that's a snake's mouth. Now we take the mouse and put him in, take a bite, take another bite. Can he get out? No. Then this means that all snakes have teeth and all snakes can bite. So when you find a snake whose head is like your, and then they repeat it, and whose tail is like a, they repeat that, then we pick him up by the back of the head. If you've got him by the back of the head, can he bite you? But you know what? Nobody, not even a snake, wants to be picked up by his head alone. So hold the rest of it in your hand until you see who he is. Now I tell this to each group I go out with, because knowledge dispels fear. So then one day I was out with a preschool group, or rather I had a first grade class out at the Wildlife Refuge, and I had told them this. And these children were from Novato, which is a long way from here, and they'd all had lunch. I said, everybody go up and use the bathroom before you go back on the bus. Pretty soon I heard this great screaming by the little restroom. I thought, I'm not going to run. I've told them what they need to know. And when I got up there, there was a little six-year-old, and he had a great big gopher snake in his hand, in one hand, and holding him tight with the other hand. And he says, hello, Mrs. the Wiggler. I did just what you said, but he's awful heavy. With a, by preschoolers and their mothers. And I had a pack on my back, and I saw a gopher snake go by, and I said to this mother, would you go get that, please? I can't because of my pack. Who, me? Yes, I told you what you need to know. Well, who are you? And she went and she came out and she says, I did it.
Well,
this is it. When knowledge dispels fear, and this is why I'm trying to teach the children the things that they need to know about in the out-of-doors, because I have them hold up five fingers, because before we go for a walk in the out-of-doors in California, there are five main things that you need to know that are poisonous. So then we hold our hand like this as though it was a little hat on top of your finger. There's a little plant that comes up every spring after the rain. Are we going to eat it? No. Who's it going to be? All right. And then I have them hold up three fingers like this and cut round edges and round edges and round edges and shine it up, paint it green, paint it red, or shake all the leaves off and let your fingers stand up like this. This is poison. Are we going to touch it? No. And then we hold up a finger like this, we paint it green, put red spots on it, a flat white blossom, a leaf like a carrot. Pick that leaf, crush it, and smell it. It smells horrible. This is Mother Nature's way of telling you to leave it alone. This is poison. And then we break the stem, and we find that the stem is hollow. We may touch it, but we do not eat it. And then we make a triangle of our hands like this, and we put it on our belly. We swing the triangle up like so. We paint our two triangles red, and the rest of us all black, and live under a rock or under a bone. And who are we going to be? Are we going to fill it? No, because it takes a job to do. And then back to the snakes, I have them hold their fingers on their jaw and feel their jaw. And if you go for a walk and you find a snake, and he's got a jaw like yours and rattles on the end, who's he going to be? You're going to pick him up? What does he have for lunch? All right, if he didn't eat Mr. Mouse and Mr. Rat, what would they do to our food? And then who'd be hungry? So if you see Mr. Rattlesnake, you're in his backyard, and you go away. So these are just five simple things that they immediately
make. Do you know rattlesnakes in Mill Valley?
They're up in Mount Tam. I've been in the county 25 years. I have never seen them. But I learned from a 9-year-old, and we can learn from children so much, that a gopher snake, which looks very much like a rattlesnake, but his head is like our finger, and his tail is like a pencil point. But he can blow up his jaw so that he looks like a rattlesnake, but the answer's in his tail. And he can also make a rattling sound like a rattlesnake, but the answer's in his tail. But these are just little observations that we use when we go for a walk, because when we go for a walk, we look up to see the snake, and around to see the snake, and then down to see who comes by, and then because he's just, the outside is just full of discoveries, and children love discoveries.
All right. Have any children that or others that you have walked with become interested in the environment enough to make it a way of life? In other words, to go into it?
I think there are several who are now finished college who are doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I run into their mothers who say, you have no idea what influence you've had on my sons.
Isn't that satisfying?
Matter of fact, I talked to one boy, and he said, I remember going with you on a field trip when I was in the third grade, and I've never forgotten it. I had just finished University of California, with a degree in forestry, and I decided I want to learn how to work with children and teach them, so they will have this knowledge of the outdoors.
Isn't that wonderful?
Never can tell. You keep planting all these little seeds, and I run into children all around, and they bring these things that they have found, birds or bones or rocks or things that they want to know about it that they have found. And then in turn, I take these things into the classroom so that other children can see them. As a matter of fact, when I was telling you about the cedar wax ring, I have all these things that the children bring to me. I put in my deep freeze so that they stay in good condition. Someday maybe I'll learn how to do the dry freeze. I haven't learned that yet, but a lot of these things that have been in deep freeze for years have dried up.
What happens to them then?
They just get drier and drier. But I take them out. They're all day at classroom, then I take them back. Once in a while, they get a little smelly. And the children will say, oh, those stinking birds. Well, this is not the impression I want to leave with the children. So I have now found a girl who enjoys stuffing them. So she has done a lot of mounting for me. So I take all these mounted specimens with me, so that I do not have to say to a child, do not touch. Because in storybooks, children are talking to animals and feeling them and friends with them. But you go to the zoo, and until they have the little children's pet area, you may not touch. And you go to the national parks, and you may not touch. But by having these stuffings, then you get color, shape, size, texture. And they just love it. They'll sit there and hold the stuffed raccoon. And matter of fact, I was in San Francisco the other day, and a possum had fallen off of a wall and broken its neck. And I thought, well, I don't have one of those in my collection, and I don't know that we have one in Marin County. As a matter of fact, the only way he'd get here would be either to swim or hitchhike, and I don't think he can do that. So I brought him. I wanted him, but I had to go on an errand, and I'm still in San Francisco now. And when I came back, there was a boy coming toward me. He says, oh, wait, look out. Just around the corner, there's a big dead rat. And I said, yes, I knew, but it wanted to rest. So I usually hold up Mr. Possum by his tail and ask who he is. And of course, a lot of them don't know, but a lot of them can guess. And then just the other day, I got to find a mother possum with a pouch and five little babies. And this girl is now stuffing these for me, so everybody can see.
That's wonderful.
Well, I have also a weasel that I found the other day, and I showed them the weasel. And one of the rangers from your woods called me not long ago, and he said, I have a, what is the fish that comes up every year from the ocean? The salmon come up every year, and steelhead. Every year the steelhead come up. The steelhead come into the stream, and they even come up in the Mill Valley. And as a matter of fact, one mother said she was standing up by the waterfall in Mill Valley, and she saw a salmon up there. Well, that was hard to believe, so I went later, and just on the other side of the road near the waterfall, there was a beautiful big salmon, and I was excited. And we did canoe up in the little creek in Mill Valley, and two big steelhead swam right up past us. And this was just very exciting. So, as a matter of fact, as you canoe in the Mill Valley harbor, little perch leap in, because in all our little creeks, in all our saltwater marshes, the fish come in and lay their eggs. And then there's food supply there. But then as the steelhead and the salmon come up into the stream, the steelhead go back each year. The salmon come up, and they lay their eggs, and they spawn. So with all the stuffed animals that I have now this stuffed fish. And then I say, well, now, let's see, Mother Nature doesn't waste anything. So as I put the fish down, we talk about the fish that has laid its eggs. Then Mr. Raccoon comes out. He says, oh, I think I'll have fish for supper. And Mr. Fox will come, and he'll have a fish for supper. And Mr. Weasel will come out. He's got to have some fish for supper. And it's just fascinating to see the things that utilize the things that nature has provided. To me, the outdoors is so exciting, because where do you go with your family from the house? You can only even stay in the kitchen house just so long, and then it's out, out, out.
Right.
Where are they going to go? Are they going to go and throw rocks? Are they going to go and destroy? Are they going to go and have the joy of discovering and see the things that are there? And to me, this is important, because when a child does not know how to create, he won't know how to destroy. But if you've given this child a sense of wonder and delight in discovering, every day, as a matter of fact, today at this birthday party I just went to, that the children had been by the stream, and they found this little caddis fly that had just got its wings, was ready to fly away. And then we found a grasshopper, and we found it. There was this grasshopper, hold him in your hand, and he'll hop. But wait, he wasn't hopping. Why wasn't he hopping? Oh, look, he has only one hind leg. And then we went down on the pier, and the men were fishing. What kind of fish did you catch? And he had a nice fat perch in the bucket, and so he picked the perch up. And we felt the perch, and then we went to another man. What are you using for bait? And so he had the sardine, and we felt the bait. And then another man was using shrimp, so we picked up the shrimp, and we looked at the shrimp. And all these things are right here. Yeah. To me, this whole area is so exciting that I don't think there's any place in the world that can touch it. Because right away you have streams, you have redwoods, you have the bay, you have the mud flats, you have the ocean close by, you have grasslands, you have chaparral. As you hike up a little further on the hills here into the chaparral area, then you have the wren tit, who sits there. Now all wrens have a perky little tail, and then you will hear this. And he's up there sitting on a bush. And then his little cousin in the bush is the one that we just did the whispering up. And he's very tiny, but he'll be in the same area in the bushes, and more as you come down into oak trees, he's going to be there. Then as you get in the oak trees, you look in the tree, and then you see these holes in it, which acorns are going to be in. And then we have many kinds of woodpeckers, because I have this in my deep piece, and I'll hold up a woodpecker, and I'll say, where is the red on this woodpecker? Oh, they'll say, and I said, but wait a minute, what part of his head? Oh, that, then you look. Because you don't always see what you're looking at. Oh, it's on the top of his head. All right, where is the yellow on this bird? Oh, it's on his throat. All right, then I'll show them another bird. Where is the red on this one? He said, but what part of his head? Oh, his face. All right, where is the yellow on this one? Oh, his belly. And then you see the tiny, tiny holes, and I have these logs. One log has a hole big enough that with acorns in it. The other one has tiny holes that the acorn wouldn't fit in it. Now, if this acorn with the yellow throat and the red on top of his head is a woodpecker and he put acorns in there, what do you guess his name's going to be? Fred Dick. What did he put in the hole?
Acorn.
All right, so what's his name going to be?
An acorn woodpecker.
All right, now, on this other log that I have are tiny, tiny holes, and this fellow says, I get awfully thirsty. What is the name of the liquid that comes up from the earth to feed the leaves?
More water?
Yeah, what do we call that water?
Well?
No. Under the bark of a tree, what do we call the liquid that comes up from the earth to feed the leaves?
I don't know.
A three-letter word beginning with S.
The bee?
No. The liquid that comes up from the earth to feed the leaves. And then in the east, it goes back down in the wintertime, but we don't have that kind of winter here. And then the leaves drop off because the sap has returned to the earth. So then this will be our yellow-bellied sapsucker. And then he's the one that makes the tiny holes that you see in a row on the trees. As a matter of fact, you go down Catalpa Avenue right down here by the elementary school, by Park School, and you'll see just rows and rows that where the yellow-bellied sapsucker has been getting the sap out of the Catalpa trees. And it's just exciting. As a matter of fact, across from the post office, there's a telephone pole. And one day I heard a peck-peck-pecking. And I looked up, and there, sure enough, were the acorn woodpeckers. They moved in. They had a nice little house right there.
The telephone pole.
And the acorn woodpecker says, Jacob, 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 Jacob. And when he flies, you can look up through his wings. You see white windows in his wings, so you know it's Mr. Acorn Woodpecker. Then one day I heard a different sound. I thought, wait a minute. That's not an acorn woodpecker sound in that telephone pole anymore as I was coming out of the post office. And I looked, and the starlings have moved in, and out have gone the woodpeckers. Starlings used to be very rare in the county, but we used to have horses out by Tennessee Valley, and suddenly I would see this flock of birds flying, and as they fly, as starlings fly, they're sort of an invisible ring, like it's around an amoeba when you look at it through the microscope. When blackbirds fly, it's sort of ragged, but when the starlings fly, it's sort of a golden glow, like this. And I'd heard about these, and right now they have come into Mill Valley, they're in my yard, they eat the cherries on my tree. And then I've seen them lined up down by the marsh on the wire. I have seen a hawk, marsh hawk, coming in to get a mouse for his lunch, and the mice are down in the pickleweed area down there, and so are the meadowlarks, and so are the other shorebirds. But anyway, he came, the marsh hawk, along looking for the meadow marsh mouse for his lunch. The whole row of starlings came off in one mass, and they dove down on this hawk. And then, they separated into two groups, and they dove alternately at that hawk until they drove him out of the area. And so it's just fascinating to watch things that are happening. We don't have any bluebirds in this area, because a lot of people say, oh, I saw that bluebird. When they're new here, they're looking at a jay. Well, in order to see the bluebirds in the county, you have to go up a little higher up where we have grassland up towards Mount Tamar, where there is a more flat grassland area.
I know that you
in addition to doing hiking, do biking and canoeing and teaching, and which is your favorite?
Well, the interesting thing about bicycling, we moved here from Strawberry so the children could bicycle to school so that I wouldn't have to drive them to everything. We were in easy bicycle range. And this went fine until it was time for my daughter to go to high school. And then I said, you ride your bicycle to high school. I had gotten her two big baskets for the side of the bicycle. And then I got to thinking, well, I knew that there were bike racks at Clark School. There were bike racks at Edna McGuire. But I hadn't seen any bike racks at Town Pius High School. And so I said, well, where are the bike racks? Well, we don't have any. What do you mean you don't have any? Well, we just don't. At that time, kids with that age wouldn't be caught dead on a bicycle. So I thought, well, if... Then I thought, but I wanted my daughter to ride. I wasn't about to drive her down. Why should I drive her at 7:30 in the morning for P.E. when she could ride her own self down to the books? And it was downhill all the way at a nice gradual slope. We didn't live up high in the hills where it would be hard, but this is an easy slope from here to Tam High, and practically level on Miller Avenue all the way back. So I said, well, you ride your bicycle. And I said, well, where are... The bicycles that somebody must be riding to school. Oh, she said, they hide them in the bushes here and there because kids are always stealing or breaking or cutting or destroying. And I thought, now that doesn't make sense. So she did ride the bicycle one day and somebody stole some part off of her bicycle. She wouldn't ride it again. So I thought, now this is, something's wrong here. We better do something about this. So I thought, well, while I'm thinking about this, I know that there must be other mothers whose kids' bicycles are in their garages. Why don't we start an adult group bicycle? So the third Monday of each month, I set a schedule to the Audubon Society. Let's go on a bicycle ride, because as you ride on a bicycle, you get to use all your senses. You can hear, you can see, you can smell, you can stop easily and pick and taste and everything. So I thought, well, now let's see how I solve this problem. I'll bet if we put a bicycle rack in, we could do something about the bicycle situation. So I went to the principal and I said, we need a bicycle rack. And he said, yes, I know, I'll do something about it. Well, shortly after that, I was at a football game and Salem Rice was sitting next to me and he said, Mr. Wilger, what happened to that bicycle rack you asked for? I was behind you when we were at the principal's office and I heard you ask for it. And I said, well, just a minute, I'll... I looked around and Mr. Crawford was sitting in back to me. I said, back to me, Mr. Crawford, what happened to that bicycle rack I asked for? He says, Mr. Wilger, I'm ashamed to face you. He said, I sent the drawing in and I don't know why we don't have it. I said, well, all right, I'll do something about it. So then I called the superintendent's office and I said, last year we asked for a bicycle rack. We sent in the drawing and we need a bicycle rack. Within a week, we had a bicycle rack. All that year, every time I would pass it, as I was going out to feed the horses, or would go down to the high school, maybe two or three bicycles in the rack. And I thought, well, I'll just wait. But the next year, you see, the incoming class didn't know that there had never been a bicycle rack there. In the meantime, we'd been bicycling all year, mothers and whole families would go, and then one of the mothers from Sausalito said to me, you know what? You can't bicycle legally from Mill Valley to Sausalito. You can't? Sure enough, as you drive towards Sausalito, right there by the Buckeye restaurant is a sign that says, pedestrians and motorized motorized cycles, not permitted on freeway. It's something like that. And I thought, now, let's see, how else would one get to Sausalito? Well, then you go over underneath the Richardson Bay Bridge and then hit there with the railroad tracks. And the railroad tracks, it said, private property, permission to pass, revocable, et cetera. And I thought, well, and then you come out on the highway and the signs say, go back, wrong way, do not enter. And I thought, yes, but here's the highway coming in and separating two towns, and it's also telling students, you cannot walk to, pedestrians and motorized cycles, not permitted on the highway. This means that no child from Sausalito or Marin City could walk to high school, let alone bicycle, legally. So I thought, now this doesn't make sense. Here is the Division of Highways telling the school department to get the kids to school the best way they can, but they may not walk and they may not cycle. Now this doesn't make any sense. A child should be able to get to school on his own. So I thought, well, one of the ladies down in Sausalito said, Miss Tozer, I'll take care of all the publicity and the television and the radio and everything if you carry this project through. So I thought, well, listen, I've passed that sign for years by the Buckeye, but it hadn't meant anything to me because I didn't have that problem. But when she said, will you take it over, I thought, but I've looked at that sign for years. Why have I been so blind? All right, I'll work with it. So then we had a meeting under the Richardson Bay Bridge of Dean Meyer, who was then the mayor. We had a man from the railroad department. We had a man from the highway department. We had somebody from the high school, somebody from the junior high school, somebody from the Sausalito School District, somebody from the... who else did we have? I've forgotten. I'll have to look it up. Anyway, we met underneath the bridge on a Sunday afternoon to discuss this fact that here was the Division of Highways telling the schools that they could not go, any child could not go to school except by school bus or by their mother driving them, or by paying as so much a day. Well, one of my friends lives in Mill Valley, and she wanted to bicycle to Sausalito. She got as far as the Buckeye, and she said an officer stopped her and said he would give her a ticket if she went any further, and she said to him, how else can I get to Sausalito? Well, he said, well, he didn't know, but he wasn't about to let her go on the highway. So I said to her, what did he say the fine would be if you went? Oh, she said, he didn't say. So I thought, well, now supposing I were to lead a group of students from Tamalpais High School to a field trip under the Golden Gate Bridge to see all the sea life along the rocks down there, I'd better go to the Division of Highways and find out what it's going to cost me just to go from the Buckeye restaurant to the Sausalito little turnoff there, so they can go home and tell their parents, because the student had asked me to lead this field trip. So I went to San Francisco to the office in there, and there were three men at the desk, and I said, I've got a problem. I've been asked by the students to lead a bicycle field trip from Town Place High School to underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, but we can't go on the freeway, which is just a very short distance from the Buckeye restaurant over. And they said, oh, we don't know what it would cost. As a matter of fact, says I, one of the men says, I know one, I understand your problem. He says, I live in Terra Linda, and I cannot get to San Rafael over the Puerto Suelo Hill there. We should have a bicycle lane there. So I thought, well, they told me to go. I should go to the Corte Madera office to find, they would know what the fine would be. So I left the city, I came over to Corte Madera, I went to the Division of Highways there, I told them the problem. These students had said, would you please lead a field trip from the high school to underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and I need to know what it's going to cost them, because this is the only way to go. Well, they said, well, they didn't know. Call the court in San Rafael, they would know. So I called the county, the court in the San Rafael's office, and the lady said, Miss Tolger, I know what you're talking about. I live in Sausalito. I work in San Rafael. My son goes to Tamalpais High School. He could bicycle very easily. It's level. But the law says no, so it costs me $1 a day for his transportation. And I said, well, do you know what the fine would be? And she said it would be between $15 and $20, depending on the judge. And I said, who are the judges? So she named three judges, one of whom was Haddon Roth. Haddon Roth had graduated from Tamalpais High School. His mother runs a regular bookshop here in Mill Valley, and I've known her for... So my daughter is now 25, and I've known her since my daughter was 10 months old. So I thought, I'll write to Haddon. Dear Haddon Roth, I've known your mother for 20 years. I understand you went to Tamalpais High School. Could you help us with this problem? According to the sign there, no child from Sausalito can get to Mill Valley, or Marin City to Mill Valley, or no child from Mill Valley can go to Sausalito to look at all the boats, or whatever they'd like to do, to ride down that way on their bikes. He wrote to me, and he said, dear Mr. Roger, I just carry out the laws. I don't make them. Write to Bill Bagley. So I wrote to Bill Bagley, and Bill Bagley had his assistant write to me and said, just put an overpass from Marin City over. That wasn't the problem at all. So I thought, well, he's not paying attention. So then I will then write to Superintendent Riles, and I will write to the Division of Highways and say, Superintendent, no, it was the other superintendent at the time, whoever the last superintendent was.
Rafferty?
Rafferty. I'll write to Rafferty. Dear Mr. Rafferty, the Division of Highways has, this is Highway 1 and Highway 101, and it's the only road, has said that no, really saying that no child can go to walk to school or bike to school from Marin City Associated to Tamalpais High School, and that's the only high school that they can go to in this area, nor can they come for summer school to Edna McGuire or summer school at Tam High. Now, this doesn't make sense. We wrote to the Division of Highways, and the Division of Highways said, well, it's really up to the school department. And I thought, no, this still isn't making sense. I'll go higher. So we wrote to Rafferty, we wrote to the governor. And then also we went to the railroad people, and we thought, well, this is, why can't we just have a bicycle path beside the railroad straight right to the high school? But, oh, no, railroad says the insurance would be too high. We've got the bridges and things. We just can't do that. And I thought, no, that still doesn't make sense. It's the only level way. Well, I'll keep trying. So then we wrote to the governor, and then we, meantime, contacted this, well, all the high school. We've explained it to them, the school district. We've explained it to the elementary school district. And so I thought, well, then let's write to Washington. So then we wrote to Maillard, and we wrote to, because he's from this area. And then we finally wrote to the man in charge of transportation, Volpe, presented our problem. And so pretty soon we had it right back in a big circle. Well, we're going round and round. We still weren't getting anywhere. So finally the bicycle people in the county got together, and we had a big meeting, and we said, let's meet once a month. Let's do something about this. So then Michael Warnham then was the new supervisor, and we said, Michael, now, Michael, would you take a sticker on your car, please? Let's work very hard on this. So then Michael helped us work. Pierre Joski helped us work. And then Mary Mayer, who lives in Sausalito, had it. In the meantime, I'd written to Peter Baer. Peter, will you help us? So we had a meeting in which we had speakers from the Golden Gate Bridge. We had speakers from the county. We had Peter Baer. And then we got Mr. McDevitt in San Francisco, because by then San Francisco was waking up to the bicycle path, so that we had many voices speaking. And then finally Mary Mayer in Sausalito said, Peter Baer had said to me, I tell you what, if you get somebody from the bridge board, somebody from the highway, and he gave me a whole list of people, if you get them all together for lunch and talk this thing over with them, maybe it'll work. Well, I looked over this list Peter had given me, and I thought, but they all work in San Francisco. Where would we all go for lunch? Maybe I could have them come out to Golden Gate Park. We could have a picnic lunch. But they said, no, no, some of them work way downtown. That would take too long. Well, where do I know downtown that we could have lunch down there? And I thought, well, I'm going to have to pay for all this. And I don't know these men. I'm strangers to them, and I sort of lost my courage. But I thought, well, I'll keep trying. So in the meantime, we'd written to the president of the railway company and asked him, couldn't we have permission to do this? And they went back, you know, and I thought, well, let's keep trying. Well, then it turned out this man that I'm telling you about, she has a cousin on the railroad board, and she talked to him. And he was finally convinced that, yes, right between Sausalito Bait and Tackle Shop, let's put a path in. Well, then also, in order to do that, you also had to get PG&E permission. So the county then has to pay the railroad a certain sum each year for the use of the right-of-way by the railroad track. And then we finally got the path put in and then had to come along the creek. Well, then we had to get across the creek as you come in on shoreline. Well, again, money is always a problem. Where would you put the bridge? Well, then they appealed to the water district that already has a pipe going over there. May we put the foundations of the bicycle path over the bridge on your foundations? And they said yes. And so then you have to come along Shoreway, and then you come into Mill Valley, right at the end of the high school. Well, this is where the county line stops. So then, well, here they are coming to high school, then the path goes a little bit further into Mill Valley. So then I appealed to our Parks and Recreation Director, who said, well, no, the public works man won't do it. And so then I appealed to the mayor, and said, we need this short stretch from the end of the high school into Mill Valley, which was done. So we've got it that far. So then the widening committee, out of this is also ready to put the path in there too, so that you can come in. Now the next problem was to get, we now had our path, everybody is gung-ho for it, the money was appropriated for it. So you can now get from Mill Valley to Sausalito, and from Sausalito to Mill Valley, but we'd like to ride across the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, I thought, well, let's see, we'd like to ride across the Golden Gate Bridge, but we understand you can walk your bike, but you can't ride it. And I thought, now this is ridiculous. In 1936, I was a student nurse at Stanford Hospital in San Francisco, and my husband was an intern, and we used to ride across that Golden Gate Bridge. Now, we thought if we could ride 30 years ago, our children could ride too. Why aren't you allowing people to ride on the Golden Gate Bridge? Well, somebody was hurt at one time. So then it turned out somebody had fallen drunk in a culvert or something. So I thought, well, I tell you what. If we put a yellow line 3 feet in from the edge of the road, if anybody falls, they're not going to get hurt. So the day the bridge was open and the off-ramp was put on, I met the bridge engineer and I suggested this, so that now on each side was a walkway, there is a 3-foot yellow line. Well, then we still had to break the barrier riding across. So I scheduled a field trip for my ladies, and anywhere from 50 to 75 people will show up if I schedule an Audubon field trip by bicycle. And I said, let's meet at the parking lot in Sausalito and ride down to the ferry boat. Some of you go by ferry around this way, because underneath the Golden Gate Bridge on the other side is the old Fort Point. Well, many years ago, I had been to this old Fort Point, and I knew that a lot of ladies hadn't, and I knew that they were beginning to reopen it. And so we had an appointment with a man there who's the historian. Would he please give us a conductor tour through? He said, yes. Now, be sure to be here between 11:30 and 12, because that's when they're not sandblasting. Because when they're sandblasting, it's so noisy you can't hear, and all the sand comes filtering down. So I thought, well, now, see, some of the ladies have gone that way. They're going to meet us way over on the ferry boat and coming back. and we were going to go this way and go across. We met at the north end of the Golden Gate Bridge. I went right to the telephone and I called the Golden Gate Bridge and I said, we are here. The man said, I'll be over in 5 minutes. So we waited, and pretty soon this little 3-wheel cart arrived with the man, and he said, all right, let's go. So we all got on our bicycles and we bicycled to the other side of the bridge, and we got down underneath the bridge to the historical site down there, Old Fort Point. It's time to have our lecture with the man before the sandblasting started. So it was a really very beautiful experience.
And after that, you had no more trouble.
After that, the bridge then was open to all bike and green for all time. That you didn't have to walk it anymore. No. You could ride.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, one other thing we were talking about was outdoor school, and I remember that you mentioned that.
All right, outdoor education. In 1963, I went to the Audubon Convention in Atilamon. A man came from San Diego. He had some young children with him at ages 10 and 11. And he said in San Diego, their school has what is called an outdoor education program, to which their children go for a whole week and live in cabins and learn about the outdoors. He said, this has been going on for 20 years. I thought, San Diego's had this for 20 years? What have we been missing? So I said, well, let's start that here. Well, it just happened that Mr. Lavorne, who was then principal of Old Mill School, had got his master's degree in outdoor education. Several of the teachers were interested in this, so right away, Mill Valley School was interested. I went to the school board. I took the film of Canyon Ranch to show them what the children were learning there and how beautiful it was. The school board decided, yes, we will do this. In the meantime, Sausalito's money had come through for their underprivileged children, so Sausalito got to go. So right away, Mill Valley was the first school to do this sort of thing in outdoor education. We had no place in Marin County that would house the children. So a place was found called La Coya, which is up in Napa, which is run by the Blind Institute in San Francisco, where their children go in the summertime. It wasn't used during the winter. And here were cabins that had been donated by the Rotary and the Lions and that sort of people, as service clubs. And there was a huge dining recreation hall, then a big old building which had been the stagecoach hotel, sort of, when the stagecoach went through, and this is the building that the teachers lived in. In each cabin were counselors, which were high school students. There were 8 children in a cabin with a counselor. They set the table, wiped off the table, and they served the food. There was a cook in the kitchen. There was a lovely pond there, and there were several hundred acres that we could wander through. And this was a very beautiful experience. As a matter of fact, just last Monday, I was out at Point Reyes National Seashore, headquarters, and we had a trip out to Chimney Rock, and we found a flower. I didn't know what it was. We went to Drake's Beach, where there is a little office with books that you can buy to tell you about the native plants, flowers and birds and fish and so on that are there. As I walked in the office, the girl said, "Hello, Mrs. Dwellinger. I remember you. I went to La Coya many years ago." And then a boy spoke up, and he was the lifeguard there. He says, "Hello, Mrs. Dwellinger. I went for a walk with you when I was in the sixth grade." So I keep meeting these children who, years ago and through the years now, Mill Valley has stuck with this program. As a matter of fact, this past year, the school board thought maybe they couldn't afford to send the children, but the parents were so excited about the idea, and because the children have been going now for about at least 8 years, they didn't want to drop this program, so the parents all got in and had a big exhibit or show or sale and raised the money, almost all of it, and then the school board said, "Well, if you're that interested, we will somehow manage the money so that our children will continue to go from Mill Valley to outdoor education, because there's no point in having national parks, state parks, and federal parks for people to go to and then have you not understand what's there." As a matter of fact, we went to La Coya for 2 years, but now we go down to Pescadero, which is in San Mateo County, because we still don't have our own building. And we were there 1 week, and in the middle of the week, there was a holiday. The children were taken the day after the holiday to a lovely little county park that San Mateo has next door to the outdoor education school, and they were appalled at the mess that the adults had left the park. It was just awful, the litter that was everywhere. And so my belief is, unless we take these children to go for a whole week to this outdoor education school, where they will learn about the outdoors, there's no point in continuing to establish county parks, federal parks, and state park, because obviously the people think, well, let somebody else clean up after me, which is not right. It is not fair for two men to have to clean up after thousands of people. If these are our parks, we should learn to take care of them. This is why I feel outdoor education is so great. An immediate problem right now is right at the far end of the high school is a triangle of land. There's sort of a little wilderness area. It has pickleweed, which shows that it's a salt marsh area. There's some dodder, which is that brilliant orange plant that grows on the pickleweed. It's called Old Goat's Beard. You can see where there's some dried salt that shows that the tide is coming here. There are salt grasses, which is part of the saltwater marsh. There are two little ditches that come in, and there's saltwater oozing in there, and there's also some fresh water because there are cattails, and I watch the little fishes, and there's a little whirligig beetle, so that you have both fresh water and salt water there. There's a little lovely weeping willow that's starting to grow, as well as a pussy willow that's there, which indicates fresh water. This area, the other day, one of the ladies called me, and I went to the school board, not the school board meeting, it's school trustees meeting. Well, it was a school board, Town Place High School board meeting. And one of the teachers said she had 90 signatures of teachers who want this little wildlife area saved. 200 residents in the area want it saved. The deer come down there to feed. I have seen 7 snow egrets standing there feeding. One of our city councilmen has gone to the board of trustees and says, "Well, we'd like that land to be covered up with blacktop. We'd like to park 200 commuters' cars." Now, this is school property. And for anybody to come in and take school property when it belongs to the school and can be used as a wildlife area that the Department of Science can study from. As a matter of fact, I sat next to Mr. Bennett, this biology teacher, and he says, "Of course we want this, because this shows plant succession. This shows what grows in freshwater, what grows in saltwater, what feeds here, who lives here." There is a huge baseball field, a huge football field. There are tennis courts. There's a swimming pool. There are 2 gymnasiums. What is there for the science department? Just this little lovely triangle. 3 years ago, Mr. Bell, who was the principal and had been the PA director up until he was recently appointed principal, I had suggested, "Let's save this triangle for the science department as a wildlife area." And he said, "If we need it, we will take it." I thought, something's wrong with this man. He's thinking, not otherwise. But I will wait. So in the meantime, I went to the PTA board and I said, "Let's pass a resolution to save this little triangle for all time." And they did. Mrs. Cousins was then the PTA president. Well, this other night when we were down at this board meeting, Mrs. Cousins was there. So Mrs. Cousins, I said, who was the next president? And could you tell me where can we get this resolution so that we can show the board that the PTA did pass this resolution? So she told me who the next president was, Eloise, and I don't remember her name offhand. Then Mrs. Pat Thompson is the present president, and I've known her for many years, and she signed this resolution saying, yes, we want this for all the time. In the meantime, the teacher who had brought the petitions from the neighborhood and from the teachers had this all typed up and gave one to each of the five trustees. And she said, I'd like to read this letter. The man said, I don't want to hear it. She says, I'm going to read the third paragraph, which she proceeded to do. And then I raised my hand because I wanted to show the slow, snowy regret and say that the PTA 2 years ago had passed a resolution to save this triangle for all time as open space for the science department. And they said, one of the trustees, Mr. David Ring from the Tiburon area, said, well, there were some campfire girls and they planted pansies one time. They wanted to down in Tiburon. And the other man, Mr. Collett, said, oh, I think it was poppies. And Mr. Ladar, the other man, said, well, there's no point in saving this silly little marsh any more than saving a silly one by Edna McGuire, or rather over there by the middle school. I was floored, completely floored, because just when you get one board of trustees educated to the importance of the out-of-doors, your environment, preserving the environment, and your city council and your planning commission, they change, and you've got to do it all over again. So I was utterly floored at the attitude of these men in this day and age when we're constantly talking about environment. They have this peculiar attitude. So in the meantime, I sat there and I wrote a letter to the new superintendent, Dr. Hawkins, whom I didn't know, and explained that the PTA board had said, yes, we want this, we passed this resolution to say this is open space for all time. In the back of me sat Dr. Shepard, also the new man, the new coordinator, and I wrote two letters, a letter to each of them. In the meantime, beside me sat Paul Rosenthal, who was one of our own planning commissioners here in Mill Valley. He said, Paul, read this letter. He said, that's fine. So I gave a letter to each of these men. Then I came up to the city council meeting where Mr. Burton and the city council were in order, because it was Mr. Burton, just this one councilman who had this idea, who'd gone to the Bridgeport and said, oh, look at all this land, nobody's using it. Well, for several years now, I've been going to planning commission meetings, hearing developers say, look at all this land, nobody's using it. And to come back to Mr. Burton and hear Mr. Burton say this, when his children had been at preschool, on preschool field trips with me when they were tiny, I am quite floored. And I simply don't understand this, because to me, to take school property and use it for a parking lot for commuters and make it all blacktop is wrong. Especially, another thing, interesting thing did happen on Monday night. This Mr. Bell, who is now the principal, whom I spoke of 3 years ago, saying, if we want it, we will take it. There was a letter from him to the planning commission saying, no, we will save it for the science department. So people can change their mind, but it takes years sometimes to educate them. So we're still working on this. Now the planning commission says, well, we'll think about this on an overall plan. But the school trustees had said it would be up to the city council. Now our city council, I think, is pretty environmentally aware, and I don't know what has changed Mr. Burton's mind why he should think this should be covered with blacktop. He is from the East. He's only lived here 6 years. My children went to Town Pius High School, and for 6 years I passed this beautiful little marsh wilderness area that would drive my kids to school. And we all love it. Everybody in the neighborhood loves it. He went to BCDC, and BCDC said, well, Joe Bottowitz, who was head of BCDC, contacted Dr. Harvey, who's a BCDC's environmentalist, from San Jose, who came and said, well, it was just sort of a marginal marsh. It wasn't that important. He contacted Dr. Gustafson, and Dr. Gustafson said, well, he felt there was a better marsh across by the railroad track. But to me, that's too far for the students to go, and nobody sees it. This little tiny marsh right here at the end of the Town Pius High School football field, everyone sees it as they go by every day. The neighbors have said, we saw the deer come down and feed. We saw the mother deer come down with her fawn and feed there. I was down there just a few minutes ago, and I walked around it, and it was cool and pleasant. I could taste the pickle weed. I picked it up, and it looks like a lot of little pickles joined together. You taste it, and you taste the salt in it. And here grows a grass. It's a very tough grass, and you pick that, and you taste it. And this is called salt grass because you taste the salt on it. Here was dock growing in this beautiful shade that turns a dark brown later on, but in the beginning, it's lovely reds and greens. Here's a little stream, and down in this little creek, here is this beautiful little yellow flower that looked like a brass button, so it's called brass buttons. Here are cattails growing, and it's a beautiful combination, salt water and freshwater area. It was cool and pleasant. There was a breeze, and you were comfortable. Then I walked across the blacktop road to where I parked my car, and the heat just radiated from the blacktop. Now, if this whole area is destroyed and covered with blacktop, think of the heat that this will radiate, especially since across the highway they've already destroyed two beautiful marshes. Now, to me, it would make much more sense if they want a parking lot for the commuter cars, take them and put them under the bridge where there's no life anyway, because where there's no light, there's no life. Nobody's using the land underneath the bridge. Take all these commuters, put them underneath the bridge where it doesn't matter, but leave this triangle alone for the high school. So this afternoon I'm going to write a letter to each of the four city councilmen and suggest this idea to leave. This belongs to the school, then leave it for the boundary department.
Well, I think that's a good idea. Last time I think we talked about the future of Mill Valley, which also didn't get on the tape, and you know how you saw Mill Valley looking in the future, or do you think it will continue to be in its present state?
I think people live in Mill Valley because it is a beautiful little town. We have outstanding people who live here who are interested in seeing that it remains a beautiful town. The people who give their time to serve on all the commissions do so because they love their town. And I think there are so many people interested in its beauty that it will always remain beautiful. There will always be someone who will see that it's like this. We could live in a city if we wanted to, but who wants to live in a city? Yeah. Here we have the trees that keep it cool. As a matter of fact, I had an uncle of my husband's come over here. He said, why don't you chop down some of these trees? And this is what keeps Mill Valley beautiful.
Right. One other question I had was, will others take up the work that you've begun? And you said you thought that they would continue with it even if you were to leave the area.
Years ago, when we lived in Strawberry, and I would go back and forth to the Junior Museum with my children, and kept working with the Junior Museum. Many of these, the Junior Museum has little auxiliaries or guilds of mothers in all the towns, and they bring their children because where are you going to go with your children? It's a long way to the San Francisco Zoo, but we have our own little museum here in which the children can learn the six habitat areas that we have in the outdoors, your bay, your ocean, your grassland, your chaparral, and your woodland. And these mothers have been with me for years, and I believe that these mothers then can carry on, as well as the women in the Audubon Society, who out of our wildlife refuge on Richardson Bay have been out there with me and have learned all the things that I have learned from being here, and I'm sure that they will continue this work. But one thing I would like, as we are planning on the development of our harbor, I would like a little building down here that would be a nature center, so that the children can be brought from our Mill Valley classrooms, kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, down to our Mill Valley Harbor, because we are preserving the pickleweed and the marshland adjacent to it. From the harbor up to East Blythedale is all marshland. And this, we have a unique study area, and to me, this would be very thrilling if we could have our little nature building. For instance, even taking one of the portables from the Edna McGuire that will be there, bring that down to our dock, because I have all these stuffed animals the animals have been brought to me, and this girl who does my stuffing for me. Because in case we leave Mill Valley, if I go elsewhere, I won't need these animals. They belong in this area. And I would like to have a nature center right down here by the Mill Valley Harbor that the middle school, Edna McGuire, and the elementary schools can all get to readily and learn. What do we have? This is our environment. What do we have? Not just, oh, look at that white bird yonder. We need to know, why is he there? What does he have for lunch? What are his colors? What does he say? When does he come out? Is he a night bird? Is he a day bird? What does he feed on? All this.